I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to the Midday News Wrap. New revelation about Donald Trump Jr.'s now infamous meeting with a Kremlin-connected lawyer raise even more questions about the Trump campaign's relationship with Russia. President Trump swatted down mention of collusion yesterday during a press conference with French President Emmanuel Macron, saying the meeting was one that anyone would have taken. And are enough Republicans taking their leader's newly revised health care bill? What's new in this week's version, and what are its chances of garnering 50 votes? Domenico Montanaro is the lead political editor at NPR. Michelle Bernard is the CEO of the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. They join me for the Midday News Wrap. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews the Contemporary American Theater Festival in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. The Fête Nationale edition of Midday starts right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you are with us on this Fête Nationale in France. President Trump has completed a quick trip to Paris, where he visited Napoleon's tomb, dined at the Eiffel Tower, viewed a military parade on the Champs-Élysées, and got to know his younger French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, a little better. He also made inappropriate remarks about the body of the First Lady of France. But gone were disparaging remarks about how no one was going to visit Paris anymore. He promised to return, and Monsieur Macron assured Mr. Trump that he was welcome at any time. Trump returns today to a Washington, D.C. that is all abuzz about this morning's latest revelation about the meeting between Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, and Russian attorney Natalia Vasilinskaya. NBC News reporting today that a Russian-American lobbyist, thought by some in the American intelligence community to be a former Soviet counterintelligence officer who may have ongoing ties to Russian intelligence, also attended the meeting in June 2016. NBC is not naming the person at this point. The president says that anyone would have taken that meeting. There are many on both sides of the political spectrum who disagree, including Mr. Trump's nominee to head the FBI, Christopher Wray. As for his largely stalled legislative agenda, other than saying what the Senate should do about their health care bill, President Trump is not, at least as far as most can tell, heavily involved in wrangling the 50 votes that Mitch McConnell needs to pass his now revised legislation. In a tweet this morning, Mr. Trump announced that Vice President Pence was working hard with our wonderful Republican senators to do what is right for the people. In the new version of the Senate bill, Senator Ted Cruz appears to have prevailed with his idea to allow less complete coverage options for some, amid worries that it will increase premiums and deductibles for others. So joining me this afternoon for the Midday News Wrap, Michelle Bernard. She's a lawyer, an author, a political analyst, and the CEO of the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. And she joins us on the phone from her office in Washington, D.C. Michelle, welcome to Midday.
Thank you so much.
And Domenico Montanaro, he's the lead editor for politics and digital audience at NPR, who joins us from the NPR mothership in Washington. Domenico, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Oh, thank you very much.
You are welcome to join our conversation as well. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle if you'd like to follow us there, and we certainly hope you will, at Midday Tom Hall. So, Domenico, let me start with you. The Trump Jr. meeting with the now five people involved in that meeting that happened in June of last year, again in the headlines this morning, this NBC News report confirmed by the AP that here's this fellow who is a former Soviet counterintelligence officer. He served in the Soviet military. What do you know about it so far? What do we know about this person so far? And what's your take on the impact this will have on this ever-evolving story?
Well, Donald Trump, the president of the United States, had praised his son for transparency and called him a good kid while in Russia. Never mind the fact that his son is 39 years old with five children and the same age as Macron, who he was standing next to. But what we've now learned is that more people were involved in this meeting than the Trump administration had said originally. There was some indication that there was somebody else in this meeting from the emails that Rob Goldstone had sent to Trump Jr. And Rob Goldstone is the publicist for a man named Amin Galarov, who is the son of a wealthy Russian real estate developer who was going in business with Donald Trump Sr., the president, for a Russian tower, a Russian version of a Trump tower, before Trump started running for president. So Donald Trump Jr. had maintained this relationship, a casual relationship, as he called it, with Goldstone. And Goldstone was the person who set up this meeting with the Russian lawyer Natalia Veselitskaya, as well as what we now know are one, perhaps two other people in that meeting. The Associated Press got in touch with the man, Renat Akhmetshin, who is a Russian-American lobbyist. As you noted, a former Soviet counterintelligence officer, though he denies being a spy, said that that was never confirmed. But he confirmed to AP that he attended the meeting. There could have also been a third person who was a translator, which NBC had also started to report on. So there's a tangled web here. There are a lot of different people involved, a lot of different players, money that that was part of this, but also Donald Trump Jr., we know, was expecting to get information that would be incriminating to President Trump's opponent, then candidate Trump's opponent for the general election in the fall, Hillary Clinton. That was his expectation. And in that email, the email said from Goldstone that this was part of a Russian government attempt to support his father. And so he knew that that was what was happening, or was told that that's what was happening. He said, I love it, especially if it's later in the summer, because that would be when he would – the president, or that now President Trump, would be running one-on-one against Hillary Clinton. So we have a tangled web, and not the last we're going to hear of the story.
Indeed. One of the fallback positions of the president and those in his circle has been to sort of blame it on Obama. This is part of what he had to say at the press conference yesterday, I guess, with President Emmanuel Macron in Paris.
The lawyer that went to the meeting, I see that she was in the halls of Congress also. Somebody said that her visa or her passport to come into the country was approved by Attorney General Lynch. Now, maybe that's wrong. I just heard that a little while ago, but it's a little surprised to hear that. So she was here because of Lynch.
So Michelle Bernard, you know, this time talking about this lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya, you know, blaming her mere presence in the country on Loretta Lynch and by extension, the Obama administration. He's had this tack for quite a while. How do you think it's working for him?
It's working terribly. Even if we were to assume that it was the quote unquote Obama administration's fault that this woman was in the country, to paraphrase a statement that I think either the president or his son made the other day, that's a nothing burger. I mean, the bottom line is that we are no longer in the umbrella of weird conspiracy theories. We now know for an absolute fact that Donald Trump Jr. And senior campaign officials of a then major party presidential candidate intended to meet with an official representative of a hostile foreign government in order to influence our election. It's not the same as absolutely colluding, but we know that they intended to collude, and the president's statement about this woman's presence in the country being the fault of Loretta Lynch does not in any way negate the fact that they were still willing to meet with her when they thought that they were going to get information that would somehow inure to the benefit of President Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton's campaign. So again, it's a nothing burger. This is as they say, it does not pass the sniff test.
And the fact that these people from the Trump campaign, his son, Mr. Kushner, Mr. Manafort, met with these two or perhaps three people from Russia, one including perhaps a translator, is the fact of the meeting illegal? Is the point or is the fact that Mr. Trump Jr. was aware of the intent of the meeting to exchange damaging information about Secretary Clinton, is that illegal? Is there anything absolutely positively illegal about either of those things?
You know, at this point in time, my personal opinion, without knowing all of the facts, is that at this point in time, It does not appear that the fact that they met with these people, the meeting in and of itself, was illegal. Now there is a question, and you know, I would love to hear more from an actual prosecutor whether or not a prosecutor would use their discretion to say that the intent to meet with a representative of a foreign hostile government to influence the presidential election, whether or not that fulfills like a conspiracy claim or some other federal criminal statute. You know, the fact that they didn't get any information or didn't get the information that they were looking for makes this difficult. What we do know, without any doubt whatsoever, is that what they were doing was absolutely morally incorrect. Every person I have spoke to says that they had an obligation to immediately report the contact to the FBI. They did not do so. The question is, do we have enough facts yet that would say that in taking the meeting they committed a crime? I don't know. But here is where there's a slippery slope, and I frankly would be worried if I was anyone who had been working in the campaign or who had attended that meeting. We keep getting new facts every day. It's possible that we'll finish our radio show today and additional facts will come in that will answer that question without a doubt whatsoever.
Yeah, that's always possible. Michelle Bernard is the CEO of the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. Domenico Montanaro is the lead editor for Politics and Digital Audience at NPR. Domenico, there has been some suggestion, and it's completely speculation at this point, that the provenance of this email chain, when the New York Times got a hold of it and prior to their publishing it, or at least publishing stories about it, Mr. Trump Jr. decided to publish the email chain himself. He tweeted it out, I guess, on Tuesday. There is some speculation that that leak to the New York Times came from either Paul Manafort or Jared Kushner. And I did have a question when this came out. How does the New York Times get a hold of an email that was between these four people, Trump Jr., Manafort, Kushner, and Mr. Goldstone? How does that email become available? Would you care to speculate as to how the Times came into possession of it?
And we also don't know who else that information was forwarded to. We also don't know who within the intelligence community may have been able to scoop up any of that information or had it forwarded to them. You know, the New York Times and other news organizations do try to at least give some, the best possible description of the kind of person that they are getting this information from. And their original story said three advisors to the White House. So that would imply it's not somebody from the intelligence community. That would also imply that it's not Russia necessarily leaking this information out and the Times getting a hold of it, but that there are folks who have some ties to the Trump campaign and the Trump White House who are still in regular contact with the Trump White House. So there's a small window of the kinds of people that could be. You'd mentioned Paul Manafort. Jared Kushner is within the White House, although an advisor, obviously, within the White House. There are people like Corey Lewandowski, who is the former campaign manager who was on MSNBC yesterday and happened to have some sharp comments saying that anybody who was wrapped up in this and was found to have been aiding or abetting a foreign government to try to meddle in the election should be held accountable no matter who it is. Wink, wink, even if it's the president's son, for example. And there are plenty of recriminations and plenty of bad feelings from that campaign. You know, the way Donald Trump sets up his organization and his White House has been to create him at the top with all of these kind of warring power centers and power factions that never become too powerful that they could, rival him, but that they kind of war with each other so that they're depressed and not able to, and constantly wanting his attention and his approval. So that's what you've had built up. And because of that, there are any number of people who it could be who may have it out for one of the three people who are in that meeting.
Can I just add to that also? It's anecdotal, but the Washington Examiner on this issue has reported, Roger Stone, President Trump's longtime confidant, the Washington Examiner, is reporting that Roger Stone claims to know the identity of the leaker who provided this information to the New York Times. Allegedly, Mr. Stone was speaking at a gathering at the Capitol Hill Club for young Republicans, and they kept pressing Mr. Stone on whether or not he knew anything about the Trump email controversy and who the possible leaker was. And again, according to the Washington Examiner, Stone concedes and says that the person's initials are J.K. And then it is further reported by the Independent Journal Review that there are three people in the Trump administration with the initials J.K. Number one, Jared Kushner, son-in-law to the president. Number two, Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly. And number three, Jeremy Katz, a deputy assistant to the president. Well, this is all anecdotal, but very interesting.
My vote is it's Jim Kessler, who's Trump's famous friend Jim, who will no longer visit Paris. I'm just making that up myself.
And we also, I don't know that we can believe anything Roger Stone says. I mean, he is somebody who bills himself as a provocateur, very similarly to the way a lot of why this story is so murky is because we don't know just how connected any of these folks really are to the Kremlin or whether or not there's some puffery going on so that they could then take that information back to say, see, we set up these meetings with the Trump White House, see how or Trump campaign, see how important we are. And then that show of importance can build themselves up to get them access to other important people that they want to trade with, which is the way Roger Stone operates, by the way.
He does indeed. Yeah, there's an interesting new movie about Mr. Stone just out on Netflix, by the way. We're going to take a little break. Domenico Montanaro is the lead editor for politics and digital audience at NPR. Michelle Bernard is a lawyer, author, political analyst, and the CEO of the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. More of the News Wrap when we return. 410-662-87 80, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. By the way, I made up that whole thing about Jim's last name being Kessler. I just made that up. All right, fake news. I admit it. Stick with me. Forgive me. We'll see you in 90 seconds.
This is your public radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, throughout the campaign, Donald Trump vowed to crack down on the number of people who emigrate to the United States. And on Monday, a conversation with two undocumented people who came to Maryland to work and to escape violence in Central America. We'll talk about how their lives have changed since President Trump took office. WYPR's Aaron Henkin will be our guest host Monday on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. Michelle Bernard is on the line from her office in Washington, D.C. She's the CEO of the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. Domenico Montanaro is NPR's lead editor for politics and digital audience. In that role, he directs political coverage across NPR's broadcast and digital platforms. He joins us from the studios of NPR in D.C. You can join us as well, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Domenico Montanaro, the president tweeted this morning that he's on Air Force One on his way back to the States, and he said he's headed to a women's golf tournament in New Jersey. I assume that it's at the golf course that he owns. He said, also said in another tweet, he said, quote, "I'd say the only thing more difficult," this was, I guess, on Air Force One the other night in a conversation with reporters that was originally off the record, then the White House made it on the record. He said, "I'd say the only thing more difficult in peace between Israel and the Palestinians is health care." So it seems that Mr. Trump is noticeably absent. He was talking about how Vice President Trump or Vice President Pence, rather, was working with his wonderful Senate Republicans to get a bill. But he is just AWOL on this effort to get 50 votes. What do we make of that?
I don't know if he's completely AWOL. I mean, I think that he's monitoring the progress. He's, it's a little bit harder to twist the arms of senators than it is, trying this sort of Macron-esque you know, invite him over for bowling kind of thing that he did with a lot of the House members. They're a little bit easier to peel off because Trump can talk about those districts as opposed to the states writ large. But Trump has had a little bit more of a hands-off approach, trusted the process to Mitch McConnell for sure on this process because McConnell's promised that he could get this done. So far, what we know is that there are – that Republicans – that this bill is hanging by a thread. You've got 52 votes for – 52 Republicans in the Senate, and they can only afford to lose two. Right now, they are at two that they've lost. So one more and the bill is sunk because, you know, Mike Pence, the vice president, would come in and break a tie, and he could do that with 50. But, you know, Mike Pence has been very involved in this effort. We know that President Trump is going to be at his golf course this weekend in Bedminster, New Jersey, where there happens to be the LPGA tour being played, and he's going to be – there's a giant, skybox sort of thing that's been built for him to be there to watch, although he likes to have the run of the course. So he is going to be at his course while healthcare is going on. And there's not a lot that he can probably do because he's not a details guy when it comes to policy. He just wants a political win as opposed to a policy win. So whatever gets through, he's going to bill as a victory for repeal and replace of Obamacare, which is something that Republicans have been promising for 7 or 8 years. And by the way, this whole idea that healthcare is complicated. Yes, it is complicated. It's a very difficult thing to do. People have been trying to reform it since 1980, if not before that, where Ted Kennedy talked about not his willingness not to take a half loaf and that he should have and encouraged President Obama to take maybe less than he would have liked. And Jared Kushner, remember, was supposed to fix Mideast peace. He could fix all this stuff. So I guess JK? Is that what we're – just kidding?
Anyway. Just kidding, indeed. Yeah. Michelle Bernard, here's part of what Mr. Trump had to say to Pat Robertson on the Christian Broadcasting Network a day or two ago.
I am sitting in the Oval Office with a pen in hand waiting for our senators to give it to me. Mm-hmm. For years, they've been talking about repeal, replace, repeal, replace. I think they passed it 61 times, repeal and replace. Uh-huh. But that didn't mean anything because you had – the minority, the Republicans, they didn't have the majority, so it wasn't going to get to the president. But if it ever did, Obama wasn't going to sign it. So it didn't mean. Now we have a president that's waiting to sign it.
So, Michelle, we've got a president who's waiting to sign it, sitting in the Oval Office with a pen in hand. He's not on the phone with Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia or Rob Portman of Ohio or Dean Heller of Nevada. Does this indicate in any way that the Republicans perhaps see him as a liability in this fight rather than an asset?
There is so much going on in my head around this question that I don't even know where to begin. I think first, before we even, you know, get to the issue of whether or not they look at him as a liability, which I think the answer is, you know, is undoubtedly a resounding yes. But if we just start with the fact that the president says he's sitting in the White House waiting for the bill, as opposed to the visual that we would like of the president leaving the White House and going to the Hill and meeting with leaders and doing town hall meetings and explaining to the American public why this proposed bill is a good thing for America, it begs the question, like, what is he thinking, you know? And then to dovetail on that, you have the visual of the president shaking the hand of Mr. Macron's wife in France yesterday in, you know, the most incredibly bizarre 25-second almost arm wrestling match with Mrs. Macron, then the president telling her and commenting on her physical shape and commenting on the fact that he thought that she was in such great physical shape, which was completely inappropriate, to now heading over to his golf course for the women's LGA LGA tournament, where, you know, from a women's perspective, you've got to be asking, is he going to be sitting and watching the golf tournament and looking at and commenting on the bodies of the golfers, to the fact that you've got all of these women who are, a lot of whom are reportedly uncomfortable with even hosting the LGA tournament at Donald Trump's golf course, but they don't have a choice because it is the biggest tournament purse of the year. So again, we see women possibly being put in a position where they are, for the sake of their livelihood, they are going to be forced to play golf or, play golf in a place where they don't necessarily feel comfortable. And then I tie that back to health care reform and what's going to happen in the ACA with regard to women. You know, women make 80% of the health care decisions for their families. Women get discriminated against in insurance policies. We don't know how this is going to impact women, but we have a president who in the last 2 days has done so many things that are offensive to women across the world that it's bizarre to hear him say that he's sitting in the White House waiting for them to send a bill to him for him to sign on the heels of everything else that's happened with regard to just Mr. Macron's wife in the last 24 hours.
Michelle Bernard of the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy, coming up, coming up after a break, which is going to happen in 10 minutes or so, we're going to have Jay Wynn Russick, our theater critic, reviewing a bunch of new shows, at the Contemporary American Theater Festival. Domenico Montanaro is NPR's lead editor for politics and digital audience. He is on the line from NPR in Washington. Domenico, the Republicans made, if I may be sort of grossly simplistic here, about 4 changes. The New York Times wrote about this as well to their health care bill from the one that they couldn't pass a week or so ago. Number one, it allows insurers to sell plans that don't comply with the current legislation. In other words, it doesn't meet all of the requirements that the ACA have. They threw some money at opioid addiction treatment, $45 billion. I know that John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, said that was like spitting in the ocean. It does restore a couple of taxes on high-income earners, which seemed like a big concession in a lot of people's minds. And it lets people use health saving accounts to pay for their premiums. The Obama administration held a whole bunch of hearings and tried to at least give the patent of transparency, but they ended up passing the bill by themselves. And in the ensuing 8 years, they lost some 200 seats because it was at the time a very unpopular bill. It's gained in popularity now. Do the Republicans risk having the same outcome if, in fact, Mr. McConnell is able to squeak by and get this thing passed with a bare minimum of Republican votes?
Yeah, I mean, their bigger problem is the fact that the bill that they've proposed is so unpopular. They don't have the public wind at their backs on this, and that's a big problem. Obamacare or Affordable Care Act, Republicans had run against it, and for many years it was a net negative. More people disapproved of it than approved of it, and that tide has turned. You've seen the Affordable Care Act actually get more popular as the years have gone on and as the alternatives are thought about. So instead of Republicans trying to repair or fix what some of the problems are with the Affordable Care Act, and there are some issues. I mean, you've had some insurers in some places drop out of exchanges or premiums being too high in some places. And those are things that could be worked together on with Republicans and Democrats, but that's not something that Republicans really want to do and go after because they've promised all these years to repeal Obamacare. And the problem they have is that a quarter of the country, Republicans, want, according to our NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll, they want just repeal the thing. They don't want to actually replace it with anything. To replace it with less is what they're trying to do, and only 7% of the country said they wanted that. The plurality, 46%, almost a majority of the country, said that they want to improve on the Affordable Care Act. And that's the opposite of what the Republican Congress is trying to do.
And Michelle, 538 has a sort of aggregation of a bunch of recent polls that say the president's approval rating is about 55%, or rather 55% disapprove, 39% approve of the president's performance. Every time stuff like the Trump Jr. emails come out or this health care bill rears its ugly head again in the eyes of many people on the left. And again, it's got like a 17% or 20% approval rating for the bill itself. There is this notion that Slowly but surely, the base that Mr. Trump enjoys speaking to through his Twitter account and enjoys having these rallies with will peel away from Mr. Trump. Do you think conversations about health care, the fact that the Republicans may be in a position where they're not really going to be able to sell the idea that they have repealed the ACA, even if they get this bill passed, or if they don't get the bill passed, do you see the base slipping away from Mr. Trump?
No. It's a question we've been asking even while he was candidate in Trump, and I suspect we will be asking this for years to come. What will it take for the president's base to lose faith in the president? I don't think that whatever happens with health care is going to significantly erode his popularity within his base. If I had a crystal ball, what I believe will erode the president's popularity with his base, and again, only time will tell. Who knows what's going to happen with Russia and health care? I could be completely wrong. But if you look back at the reasons why so many Democrats and Republicans voted for the president, and basically said, you know, a pox on your houses to both Republicans and Democrats, and went with Donald Trump, I think it is those same reasons why those people might eventually turn against the president, with those reasons being, number one, some people have been told by somebody who they believe in because they gave up on everyone else that manufacturing, for example, is going to come back to the United States, that coal is going to come back to West Virginia, that everyone is going to have affordable health care, that you don't need to go to college, that, you know, it's college is a great thing if you can do it, but you don't need to. It is elitist. We're going to make America great again, and you can move forward with a high school degree and still have the kind of life that you want to live. All of those things, in my belief, are politically and from a policy perspective untrue. And I think when the president's core base of believers sees that they have been once again lied to, and that coal isn't coming back to West Virginia, and manufacturing is not coming back to the United States, at least not in a significant way, and that we live in a global economy that requires everyone to retool and be prepared from an educational perspective for that type of economy, I think that is when the president's base will erode, because people would have been lied to by virtually everyone who has represented them.
And Domenico, I mean, people have been guessing that, you know, the base is going to erode. There's a piece in the Post, I believe today, the Washington Post, talking about Ivanka Trump's company, which relies exclusively on factories out of the United States. This is despite her father's insistence and even, you know, scolding American companies for outsourcing their manufacturing. I mean, how do you see the pace of this erosion going? Most polls point to the fact that it is eroding. I mean, people have been talking about its erosion since, you know, the spring. But how do you see that?
The only real erosion I've seen is with independents. You know, Donald Trump won independents in the presidential election in 2016, 46-42. And according to our polling, that has dropped off significantly. Now he's a big net negative with independents. And that's a significant thing. But we're in a time in this country of such political polarization that the Trump campaign, really the White House and their campaign apparatus, have made the choice that this is going to be a base election and that that's the way they're going to be able to win. I would say don't expect the base to ever leave this president, because I think that what he ran on, in addition to this cultural, in addition to this economic anxiety, we can't deny that there was a cultural movement with Donald Trump of a lot of white resentment that was taking place in the country, and people feeling like that there was a rural, anti-rural bias, and that the coastal elites are the ones who are running the country. And there was a degree to which they didn't like Hillary Clinton for one reason or another, whether it's because she was a woman or whether they didn't like her personally, didn't like her history. So there there are a lot of those reasons that I don't think will ever change for those folks. But I do think that traditionally what has moved the country away from a president when they've fallen to numbers that mean that even their own party and base are not supporting them any longer have to do with two things: war and the economy. And currently the economy is in a strong position, you know, still slowly recovering, but still to practically full employment in the country. Not that there aren't pockets of difficulty in the country. There are. And in as far as war goes, while we are engaged in various theaters, we are not at the level of the kind of troops deployed overseas like we were with the Iraq War, for example, or Vietnam. If you were to see something in foreign affairs go terribly wrong to show like some level of incompetence that this hasn't worked out well, or you saw the economy and unemployment rates start to tick up, I think those are the two areas where then you would see some abandonment.
Yeah, and we had a jobs report earlier this month that showed 220,000 jobs added to the economy. The stock market, the Dow Jones, broke another record just yesterday. A couple of emails from some listeners. This is from Murray in Clearville, Pennsylvania. Says the Trump team's trying to claim that the Russians had no intelligence connections, or at least that they didn't know it. But what do they have to be named? Natasha Fatale and Boris Badenov. Well, Murray, as my dad used to say, everybody's a comic. And here's Emily writing from in another email. Says, I keep hearing reference to the, quote, fact that there was no information gained from the meeting between Trump Jr. and the Russian attorney. As far as I can tell, this information comes from Trump Jr., who has lied repeatedly about everything regarding this meeting. Is there some other source for this conclusion, or are we just taking Trump Jr.'s word for it? And Emily, I don't think anybody's really taking Mr. Trump Jr.'s word for it. But Domenico, is there another source that says nothing came of this meeting? Do we know anything about that?
I think we really need to caveat this. I think that the listener's correct in saying that we shouldn't say that there was no information gained, but it has to be sourced to the fact that from what the White House has said and from what Donald Trump Jr. have said, there was no information gained. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there wasn't some level of information that was exchanged. From what they have said so far, that this conversation was about, quote, adoption, which, by the way, we have two pretty significant things without even needing to know what information actually came of this. The fact that there was an email exchanged that said that this was an attempt by the Russian government to help Donald Trump win the presidency as part of that effort. Donald Trump Jr. saw that and went to the meeting thinking he was getting incriminating information about Hillary Clinton. She didn't deliver the goods, quote unquote, so he was disappointed and called the meeting a bust. Yet, what they did talk about when it came to adoption is no small fact, because that is intertwined with sanctions, which we know is what the Putin government wants most lifted within American policy toward Russia. So, you know, without even knowing what the information was that was exchanged, and we still need to ask those questions and find out what information was exchanged and if there's any documentation of it, there were some pretty significant stuff that we already know.
And Michelle Bernard, we just have less than a minute left, and I want to bring up the issue of this voting fraud commission that the president has put together, which seems to be on hold. They asked for all sorts of information about personal voting records from all 50 states. Very few states have agreed to comply, if any, at the moment. Is this another thing that the base is going to be disappointed in, assuming that people in the so-called base buy Mr. Trump's contention that there were as many as 3 or 4 million people who voted illegally in the last election? Is this another shoe dropping in that score?
I think that it probably will help the president if he's unable to get the commission off and running, because the base wants to believe that there is massive voter fraud across the country being perpetrated by people who look different than them, and you know, and the president will be able to use this as a rallying cry about why he needs to continue to work hard and drain the swamp, because look at what these people are doing to our country. So I don't think that the base will look at this as a negative against the president. They're going to want to sure they're man up and do everything they can to help him weed out, quote unquote, weed out the people who are allegedly engaging in voter fraud.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Michelle Bernard from the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. She's written several books, including Moving America Towards Justice, The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, 1963 to 2013. And Domenico Montanaro, he's with NPR in their Politics and Digital Audience Divisions. Thank you both to you. I appreciate it, and have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
And thank you so much for having me on.
And coming up after the break, our theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us to review the new plays at the Contemporary American Theater Festival over in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We're glad about that. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, member supported, 88.1 WYPR.